You're listening to a DayOne.fm show.
If you were speaking to a Kiwi founder, perhaps, who's thinking about entering the US market, what advice would you give? And how did you think about pricing your product in the US?
Whatever price they have right now, triple it is the first thing, regardless. Because Kiwis, and I can say this, we're tight bastards, right? And I think we don't value sell. And I think we don't do a great job of articulating our value. And then also don't assume and go into a meeting assuming that it's too expensive either. Do not talk about the price. Do not talk about discount. Just go on the value and don't just sit there rabbiting off features.
Hi folks, and welcome back to Diaspora.nz. We're on a mission to seek out and profile the hidden gems, the best founders, operators, researchers, and emerging leaders of the great Kiwi expat community. Today we're talking to Campbell Brown, founder and CEO at Predict HQ. Cam's another Kiwi based up in the San Francisco Bay Area. We talk about what they're up to, of course, helping their customers with demand intelligence. That's understanding what factors drive local customer behavior. And of course, some of the fun things you can do once you've got that. We talk about growth tactics, leveraging SEO to crack the US market and how that playbook has to evolve in the coming AI era. We talk about pricing for usage-based products, how to think about landing pilots with big customers and scaling them into initial contracts. We talk about manufacturing serendipity and fundraising and the big unlocks that led to Cam's Series A and B rounds, as well as scaling and managing teams that span the US and New Zealand geographies. Campbell was one of the OG podcast guests I had back when I first kicked this show off in Season 1 in 2017 and 18. So my first repeat guest. Since then, they've raised over $33 million. They rode the ultimate test of volatility in the pandemic and are now going from strength to strength, closing big global brands. I really enjoyed recording this episode, so I say we go get sucking. Campbell Brown, welcome to Diaspora.nz. You are my first repeat guest, which is really exciting because and it would have been 7 years ago, I think we spoke last. Predict HQ was in its much, much earlier days. Since then, you've raised Series A and a Series B. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited to get the journey, but welcome. Thank you, first of all.
Yeah, no, good to be here. Good to be back all these years later.
What we'll do is I think there is so much that has happened in the past 5 years. I want to focus our attention there. I would encourage, and we'll link back to the original episode, but for those who are listening for the first time, give us the quick rundown on Predict HQ today, and then we're going to go back in time to hear how you came to it, and then we're going to go into the future and where you're off to next.
Yeah, I mean, I think the same thing applies today as it did when we started the business, which is we're trying to predict the catalyst behind any form of demand. And so the catalyst of which we have dialed in on are events. And now an event can be severe weather, it can be a baseball game, it can be a rugby game, it can be a conference expo, it can even be school holidays. And what businesses struggle with at the moment is the ability to consume this information in either to their operations team, into their forecasting models, into their generative AI, to be able to then make their business more real world aware or to give it context. And so a good example of that is, you know, one of our longtime customers been with us from nearly day one, Uber. They use us to get drivers in the right place at the right time ahead of time.
Is that what's powering the surge pricing that people get hit when they see it? Or is that actually running ahead of it and it's getting the drivers in the right place should theoretically reduce the surge pricing because it would increase supply?
Yeah,
right?
I mean, it's more on customer satisfaction and driver ROI. And so what I mean by that is you roll out of a baseball game at, you know, 7:30 or 9 o'clock at night and you want to be able to get into an Uber pretty quickly. And so to reduce those pickup times, even around a major event, is about customer satisfaction. And then on the driver side, it's about how do we give drivers more work at a higher rate? And so because some of these events are traveling large distances. And I guess what we know from the likes of Uber and Lyft, who are both customers, they're shifting anywhere between 20 and 30% of the people that are going to these games. There's billions and billions and billions of dollars every single year. And the unique thing with our business and what we look at is events are constantly changing. They're not a static existence. You know, someone might put on a new event or an event might be canceled or postponed. And so that unique data or that unique nature of our data being alive is the very fact as to why we created this business. Because before this, we had a car rental crew RV business and we were struggling to capture and understand what was shaping our demand.
It seems like you've been on one side or the other of the demand generation and, you know, supply service for a long time, like back in Grab One. I mean, take us right back to the early days just for a second, because Grab One was all about driving huge volumes to particular businesses. Was that part of the genesis or where did this idea really come from?
It was part of the genesis for our data can be used to empower businesses. Because, you know, back in the day, this is when we're dealing with exact target. I think we had about 2 million people in our database, which for New Zealand, as you know, is pretty big. But we were able to build unique templates for every single one of those subscribers based on what they were searching on, what they were buying. And that significantly improved our open rate, click rate, conversion rate. And so that for me was a genesis of what data can do for a business at scale. And then even through that, we started to actually manufacture events. I remember one of our best days, I think we called it International Sushi Day. It was just made up, like it didn't exist. But we just had loads of amazing Japanese restaurants from around New Zealand, like on the site. When you create that and manufacture it, it drives demand. And so in a way, that was always in the back of my head. And then when I went to Online Republic and was there, we saw firsthand that because we didn't know that the rugby league game, New South Wales versus Queensland, state of origin, jeepers, I've been out in New Zealand for too long. But we knew 16 days before that event is when most people were searching on booking car rentals. And so we knew that when that event happened again in another location, we would ramp up our advertising spend 16 days out from that particular event. And we crushed the numbers because look to book ratios were exact. We knew there was a significant amount of demand and were able to activate on that. And that was one of the reasons why we went and created this business after we exited from Online Republic.
The term that I think you've put on this that really caught my eye was this demand intelligence. Maybe you're trying to manufacture or you create a category around demand intelligence. And the example that really made it click for me, heard you talk about somewhere how Uber cares about a baseball game between two local teams because there's going to be a lot of local demand and supply, whereas Airbnb doesn't. They only care about people who are coming into a region from outside of that. And it's really interesting just thinking about how an individual business has to measure the impact of an event. Could you talk us through the way that you've done that? There was a couple of different ranking, a lot of thought and a lot of experience has gone into it.
Back when we were talking about it, we had a theory that we could consume anonymized demand from our customers, and then we could actually predict what events impacted them. And so back then it was a bit of a pipe dream. And today we actually have that and it's being actively used by a lot of our customers. And we call that product Beam. And so what that does is you have the likes of any business out there. They could push their anonymized demand data to us and they can understand by location what is surging that demand. And so for a Airbnb, they know that this conference for the dental surgeon, there's actually 60,000 dentists arriving in Atlanta on this particular day is going to surge demand. Or, you know, for Airbnb, when you look at the baseball game, if it's Giants versus the A's, it's a local derby, you know, or Arsenal versus Tottenham. So Airbnb don't care about that so much. Not driving demand, but Uber significantly care about it. And so what we've learned over the years is the shape of demand varies by location, by business type. And so we had to create a technology that enabled these businesses to get that relevancy at scale. And I think what it's now enabling us to do is to build new products and features around that anonymized demand data to better serve our customers as well. So I think we were a little bit ahead of our game because we've been using this level of intelligence to help train models for years. And now training models is all the rage. And so for us, whilst COVID was an absolute nightmare, the surge in AI is certainly our tailwind for us as we give context to these models. Like, how does your model understand that it's going to be impacted by this baseball game on this day, which last year didn't exist?
I mean, honestly, I was in a similar position of having a business that was really reliant upon in-person events. And then this huge black swan event comes along and it's the ambiguity, the uncertainty of what could happen. What was going through your mind back then?
Oh, mate. Yeah, it was a dark old time. I never want to go back to those times. But I think ultimately, you know, when you go through that heartache and you go through those really, really tough things, it's super cliche, but it does make you so much better at what you're doing. You know, you think far more conservatively about where you put your capital. Yes. You think about all sorts of things because, you know, for us, what happened is you had events completely imploded.
Yep.
So 50% of some of the data that we were seeing was attended events. We had severe weather, we had school holidays, etc. But the shape of that had changed. And then on top of that, at the time, 80% of our customer base was travel hospitality. But what COVID taught us is that, look, we needed to diversify. And so we've significantly diversified our customer base now. You caught me on a good day because literally 5 minutes before we jumped on the call, we closed one of my all-time, if not the biggest brand that I grew up as a kid.
Wow.
Super amazing. And pre-COVID, we weren't even talking to these brands. And this is a large retailer who produces amazing footwear.
Yeah.
And we didn't have a go-to-market to get these customers on board. We didn't have anything. And now what COVID taught us is like, hey, everyone, big or small, are impacted by events. And so I think, you know, that was important for us. I think the darkest day for me, it was, I think, 40 degrees. We were locked down and the fires were happening and it was like Mars outside. And I was this close to saying to my wife, let's just pack up and go back to New Zealand because I don't know how long this is going to go on for. But we stuck it out, mate. I'm glad we did. And
yeah, you would be. So that was one of, I mean, it's the largest imaginable category of an unscheduled event, I suppose. And you've spoken about how weather generally is an unscheduled event. So if you have a hurricane coming, there's going to be a sort of a predicted surge in demand for, you know, water bottles or first aid kits and things like that across there.
Yes.
When you talk about diversifying yourselves, certainly customers would be one, just, you know, instead of being so reliant upon the travel industry. What have been some of the other biggest categories that have really glommed onto it? And I'd be really curious, it seems like there's so many different use cases, so many different things you can do with the product today. What are the things that have surprised you?
Yeah, I think there were some obvious ones in plain sight that we just hadn't tackled. I think parking.
Yeah.
It's one of our largest subcategories of transportation because think about these massive fixed assets that they have to understand how can they better yield from these fixed assets. And so one of the big things is when they're pricing based on demand and some of these parking assets, they have no idea what was going on. And so we're able to automate a lot of the painstaking work they used to put into doing this. I mean, we had a business join us about 2 years ago and they had a team of 11 people scouring the web for events. And so we just said, look, let's just do a comparison between what you see and what we see. And I think probably about 80% of the events we provide, they had probably about an error rate of around 35%. So manual entry error rate. And when you think about the world of AI, you can't feed models trash. And I think that's what's not talked about a lot in AI is actually what is feeding it? How good is that quality? What is the production of those results? Because we've lived and breathed data quality since we started this business because we've been used in forecasts. We're helping people to understand how many staff do I have out in my store in this location on this day if there's a demand surge. And that discipline has actually was very painful for us because it cost a lot of capital, but now it's paying massive dividends because we're able to scale or consume not just event data, but demand data, venue information, information about what quarterback is playing on that particular day, which might increase the attendance at a particular event. So all of that is possible because of what we've built.
I'm really curious because this is such a huge future-facing opportunity when you talk about quality of unique supply data that's being streamed into models. I'm curious how you think about the defensibility of that as well. So you had been so far ahead of your time and making it easier to capture a lot of data and clean it up and tag it. Another company that comes to mind is Scale AI. I've done a lot of that, you know, just for general purpose model training. Do you think that going forward, like, is it going to be easier for people to scrape their own data using LLMs? Is it going to be, you know, easier for them to tag, filter, prepare data to go into their models? That may not be true. Maybe you still have sort of the unique advantage there, but I'm just curious, like, how you might respond. Is there an opportunity for you to go and acquire exclusive rights to data streams? Do you have sort of more proprietary hardware-based sensors that could be incorporated and streamed in?
Yeah, there's a couple of things to that. So let me just tackle the first one, which is just around simply being able to consume a large amount of data at scale and tag it, et cetera. So partway through COVID, as we're just coming out of it, we had another business take us on. And you might know them. So it was Google. And so Google had ripped off our content on our website.
Wow.
It was quite funny. And what they did is they effectively threw a grenade over the fence and said, hey, we've given you all this data. We've tagged it up later. And what people quickly realized is if there is no way to filter, if there's no way to build relevancy, if there's no intelligence associated to it, you can't actually do as much as you think you can with it. And so what I mean by that is the reason why these customers is that it's like a fire hose of data. Like, how can you actually then start to manipulate it? And so what we've done is we've built models on top of our data. And that's kind of where the secret sauce is. It's not necessarily that there's a baseball game on how many people are attending it. When is it going to finish? How much spend is going to be generated? They're actually the key attributes that are used to then train models, not the event itself. And then on top of that, what we are doing is building up, I guess, a war chest of unique data that can be used to train models that no one else has access to. And that is a really big part of what we've been building probably for the last 2 to 3 years. So one of the things in COVID is we were very lucky that just before COVID hit, literally the day the money went in the bank was the day the first case of COVID came out in the US. And we had a couple of choices we could do there is just go mothball the crap out of everything and just sit there and ride it out. Or we could actually go and be very cautious with our capital, which we absolutely did. But we decided to build and we decided coming out of this, what do we want to have? Part of that was Beam. And Beam is the ability to consume large amounts of different demand data. And demand for us is it can be footfall, it can be transactions, It can even be, we consumed the other day, we consumed some ambulance 911 calls.
Brilliant. You could even use one to sort of accentuate the other, that, you know, the fact that you have a lot of the demand data from Uber might help you to predict the parking data. It might help you to understand, like, if people are going to be ordering pizzas before they jump in the cab or afterwards when they get home. I can see like a network effect as all of these unique data streams build upon each other, though. Yes. I suppose there's also a data independence and privacy consideration on the other side of that.
100%. So a couple of things on the privacy side is, we have never from day one ever wanted to know that David has bought a hamburger at this store. We just want to know, is there demand increasing at this particular store? Right. And that they sell burgers. And so that's the way in which we have really been maniacal on that front. And I think that's paid dividends, because now with the privacy side of data is hot topic. I was in Washington, D.C. last week, and there is a lot of money being poured into data privacy at the moment. But then the other thing, mate, we've always had the back of our head, and I said this earlier, is predict the catalyst behind any form of demand. And the way we've tackled it is, we've started it in a local manner. And what I mean by that is, if you can understand what moves demand for a coffee shop or a pizza shop or transportation for accommodation for airlines, you can begin to understand what shifts economies. And that's what we're building. You know, we want to be able to understand what shapes anywhere from Danville to Timbuktu. Like, what is it?
Because that struck me that you're almost building a mass simulation of a variety of different economies in there. Like, you know, shifting from weather forecasting has basically been one big prediction model for a long time to any aspect of, you know, an event you can simulate in advance independently of the input.
Yeah. I mean, look, one of our great customers, Zydeco, so they're a DMO, destination marketing organization. They're doing amazing things with this type of data as well. Anyway, they're helping destination marketing organizations better understand what sort of events should we have on this particular day, this particular time of the year, that's going to generate this city the most ROI.
What's the data source you haven't managed to crack, or like, you think something that might be possible in the future that you haven't managed to unlock yet?
So what we have done is, we've done predicted live TV events, so predict the viewership of events. One thing that we're working towards at the moment is predicted demographics. So for this Taylor Swift concert, what's the demographics of that particular event? So as we begin to make more and more inroads into marketing, we're seeing that's not actually too difficult to crack. We've got a very clear plan on how we want to crack it. It's just more around roadmap and timing and everything.
What's a key piece missing that you need to build?
It's just time, mate. It really is. It's time and priorities. You know, another thing out of COVID that taught us is, we've got to be really, really maniacal on how we prioritize our roadmap. Like, what is the commercial outcome of what we're trying to build here, or what innovation is it going to drive? And I think I was guilty of this pre-COVID, of just like, hey, I fancy doing this week, let's get it in the roadmap. And I think that's really challenging, not just for myself, but for the team, because, you know, you've got a really thick and fever year now. I'm doing a plan of what I want to achieve this year and how we want to go about it and why we want to do it, and try to give people a view on the bigger picture. So this year is very much focused on continuing to build out unique data and unique intelligence. And because for us at this part is, we enable smarter AI. I'm not going to sit here and blow smoke up your ass, mate, and give you all these one-liners about AI. But what I am going to be able to tell you is that we absolutely 100% enable businesses to become context aware, to understand what is definitively impacting their business. We're not talking about, you know, it makes your brand 10% more well-rented. It's like, no, this is going to either surge your labor needs, it's going to, you know, decrease your food wastage because you've planned accordingly. Events are vastly, vastly impactful. And the other cool thing that we've just done is, we also now are starting to do automatic value quantification. So we can tell customers, for this particular store, how much of your demand was generated by events. And then also, if you use us, how much money are you going to make in the future from using our technology? And the key thing there is, that's the whole prediction side is, by the way, in 30 days, this store here is going to get absolutely slammed. And by events that you might not think you're going to get slammed by. And there is a really famous restaurant brand over here who came in and uploaded their demand data for one of their stores. And in this restaurant, you have an arcade and you have a sports bar. Now, when you look at this store, you would go, oh, that conference that's happening 0.2 miles away from that store, that's going to slam that place, right? And so you have this bias, and we want to remove all bias from the way that we look at it. But when you actually look at the data, a youth sporting game that had 1,017 people go to it was one of the biggest impacts of this particular store. Why? When you finish baseball, the kids want to go play in the arcade and the adults want to go drink beer. And so this is what we're solving at scale across anywhere, because location matters, business type matters, event matters.
I want to ask a slight cheeky question, but if this is all true and everybody's going to have access to perfect demand information in the future, or simulation prediction of the future, I saw that Wendy's, I think, had experimented with a dynamic pricing model and got a bit of slack for that on social media. Will everybody be out there doing dynamic pricing and raising the prices of their burgers straight after the big game? Or how do you sort of see that merging back into society, or how are customers actually using the information?
I think when we go back to parking, everyone's got fixed assets. Now, those fixed assets also, it's going to be times when they have no demand, you know, and when those low demands are, they will actually, rather than yield, they'll sell through. You see this with airlines today. You see this with accommodation that, you know, when you get a great deal on a hotel, it's because there's probably going to be no demand in there, but it's a great time for you to travel. And I think what it's doing is it's just the shape of demand begins to work around what's actually happening in the world. So whilst, yes, there'll be times where prices are a lot higher. And look, don't get me wrong, one of our customers absolutely crushed me in Nashville, but there's 410,000 people going to this event in Nashville in June. Like, lack of the yield, right? But conversely, if I went a week earlier, then we would have been fine. In fact, it was actually a lot cheaper. So yeah, there's good and bad parts to it. But you know, I'm a capitalist at heart. And I think people need to yield when they can yield, but then sell through and do discounting or promos when the opportunity arises as well.
Yeah. Yeah, we're all used to the price dumping when there's a car park right next to a major event. And as you say, that perhaps could be the free market clearing itself and capitalism at work. And it appeals to people who want to pay and not to those who don't. So you're right to call it out. I want to switch gears a little bit too, because a lot of the beauty of having folks like you up in market, and you know, you've been in the Bay Area for must be about a decade now, eight years?
7 years now, yeah.
So you gave an answer about Google before, about how Google came into your space. You've got a real life anecdote to answer the question, what if Google decides to compete with you? You know, in old school New Zealand VC, people used to worry about things like that. It seems like it's not a worry right now. You know, you basically pushed on, built a better product. Pricing seems really interesting, really valuable for you in particular. I believe you'd started out with a product with a SaaS model. You're doing a transaction usage based thing now. If you were speaking to a Kiwi founder, perhaps, who's thinking about entering the US market, what advice would you give? And how did you think about pricing your product in the US?
Whatever price they have right now, triple it is the first thing, regardless. Because Kiwis, and I can say this, we're tight bastards, right? And I think we don't value sell. And I think we don't do a great job of articulating our value. And look, I'm guilty of this as well. But, you know, as I said to you before, we're in a category of one. So we don't have any benchmarks against, you know, how good or bad we are. So what we've had to do is we've had to build a system that actually tells you how much money you have made and are going to make from our business, right? That then enables us to then charge a fair market rate for accessing our intelligence. In fact, it was too bloody cheap. You know, when you're in a market of one, mate, that's the challenge. So for these Kiwis coming over here, is just think about, what is the value you create? Can you prove that value? And then actually build a model behind it, you know, and think how you're going to charge. And then also don't assume and go into a meeting assuming that it's too expensive either. Do not talk about the price. Do not talk about discounts. Just go on the value and don't just sit there rabbiting off features. Oh, we do this. Like for me, man, the way I start is I talk about stories. I talk about your Ubers. I talk about Domino's. I talk about Chipotle. I talk about all these businesses that are using us and how they're using us. That's what people want to hear. Are you going to help me reduce my labor costs? Are you going to help me reduce my wastage? Are you going to increase my pricing or help me yield? Don't talk about, well, I have this little doo-wacky over here that's going to make you feel better on this day. And then it's like, talk about the value. It sounds simple, mate. And a lot of people nod their head when you say it, but when you actually go on there and look at their pricing, it's not there. I mean, you go onto our pricing page today on our self-serve. Guess what happens? You go in there and you go select a city or a location in your categories. We are automatically building the price next to you. And then we tell you, here's how much data you get access to for that price. And also, this is how much spend is generated from these events you get access to. Immediate value quantification. I remember one of our early investors saying it to me back in 2018, and I was like, yeah, I'll do it. I'll get to it. And now it's like a big, big part of our go-to-market.
Sell the value, not the features, I think is a punchline to take out of that. You gave an example earlier of a cafe and you said, like, you can look at this and say, based on this event, this is how much money you're going to make, or this is how much additional margin you could make. What's the granular level of pricing you're going in with? The extreme version would be, you're going to make an extra $100,000. We're going to charge you 10% of that and take a basically a transaction rate. It's going to cost you $10,000. Maybe, you know, the more hands-off version might be, in order to make that extra $100,000, you're going to need to make 1,000 API calls.
Yeah.
And we're going
charge you by the API call, or down the very hands-off, basically the plain fixed pricing would be just a SaaS subscription. You're going to make $100,000. All you have to do is pay us $1,000 a month. And it sounds like you're coming in right down the usage-based end of that. But I'm just curious, like, to what granular level can you actually get into the customer's earnings?
Yeah. So at the top level, how we charge is how many categories of data do you need? Do you need forward visibility and historical visibility to train your models? And then how many locations do you need that in? That's kind of the baseline. We have aspirations to move into more consumption-based. We have something called a features API. You know, a lot of our customers are starting to use this. It enables you to get up and running like within a matter of days and improve your forecast really quickly because it's pre-built features sitting in an API. It's awesome. But the other thing, one of the ways we charge is we notice that hotels are like, hey, this event that's 30 miles away from me in the same city doesn't actually impact me. And why am I having to pay for that? And so what we actually did is we used a lot of the hotel data that sits inside our data lake to then go, actually, that demand data, we also use population density, and we actually came up with a model that then predicts how far out you should search, like a blast radius around a hotel. How far out should I be searching for events that impact me? Then we actually enable people to pay for that, meaning I don't want to buy a city, I want to buy a point in radius. And we predict how far out they go. So that actually makes it more cost effective for them, less wastage, and they get more relevancy through. So we're actually using, you know, some of this demand data we have to make life a lot easier for our customers as well. Because the key thing here is like, how much value can we get to these customers as quickly as possible? How can we get into their jobs to be done? Some are super complex, but the other key thing here, mate, that has happened only in the past year or year or two is demand forecasting is becoming democratized. So we have a really small restaurant group. They've got about 50 restaurants across the US. So we have an SMB team to mid-market. We have an enterprise team. And they said, hey, we use Power BI. Inside Power BI, they have an auto ML feature. Power BI, mate, it's doing forecasting, right? They were able to use our features API for model training, then brought in our events API for explainability, and they were able to improve their forecast accuracy by 18.6%. This is a team of one person using Power BI. That's about $93,000 saving per restaurant.
You've spoken in the past about how you started out building a UI for people to log into, and you learned that people don't want to do that. They don't want another system to go log into. They want APIs. But if somebody did want to basically be a customer, build their own UI, they could basically compete with you. And maybe that's okay because they're going to go serve sort of a longer tail of the market. They're going to build the API that, you know, small restaurants are going to be able to log into and do their demand mapping. Have you seen that happen? Have you seen someone sort of try to compete with you on top of your own product?
Not really, mate. The way we approach it is, you know, we've got some amazing technology platform customers out there like Duetto, Lighthouse, and they're serving the accommodation sector. And they are surfacing events to their accommodation providers are also helping, they're also feeding it into their forecasting models. But the key thing there, mate, is do you want to build a business that is widely applicable across a multitude of different categories, or do you want to go deep and narrow? And we decided to go broad applicability. So think about it like Google Maps. Like many, many people want to use Google Maps. And so for us, it was like, let's become the Switzerland and let's provide them with a super clean source of unique information, intelligence built on top of that, and the infrastructure that enables them to best serve their specific customers. Because at the end of the day, mate, do I want our sales team getting on a call with, you know, David's coffee shop in Parnell? Absolutely not. But I would love it if one of our customers were surfacing our events to them and enabling them to make smarter decisions. Because at the end of the day, you have people like Visa trying to service them. You have people like Square trying to service them. You have people like thousands of platforms. I would rather, in terms of when I think of gross profit margin and I think of a sales team, I would rather be trying to work with those platforms that are servicing these customers. Because at the end of the day, the thing I want to get to is a point where we are default on. Meaning, if you don't have Predict HQ, your customers will begin to question the validity of your platform itself. And that's already happening in a lot of the accommodation providers as we're getting people coming to us saying, look, people have seen you in Lighthouse and Duetto and Blastness and all these platforms and we don't have events. We've been trying to do it manually. It doesn't scale, our forecasts aren't adapting to it. So we need to come and talk to you.
Certainly eases the burden of customer service and success in a big way as well.
Yeah, totally.
I want to get back into put yourself in the shoes of a possibly New Zealand based, or maybe they've already left the country, but founder thinking about entering the US market. I love the idea of, you know, sell the value on features. That's one headline. What else do people get wrong about scoping out their customers, about understanding the cultural differences? What common mistake did you make, or have you seen other founders entering the US make?
Yeah, I mean, I think making sure that when you come to the US, you hire talent that has actually, and I've said this for years, that's seen true scale, more so from a go-to-market point of view. So who are the people that have worked, you know, for startups selling to bigger enterprises or have worked in enterprises, et cetera, because they have a different mentality. They have a different level of understanding. And I think what we might make is they might leave their GTM in New Zealand. I think for us, we've left our R&D team in New Zealand, and I think that's a competitive advantage for us because we've got super talented people back there as well. From a go-to-market perspective, we were always going to build it out in the US and in the UK because the access to talent and what they've seen, how they price, how they negotiate is very different to talent in New Zealand. And that's a sweeping generalization. And there are amazing salespeople in New Zealand and do great things. But I think getting on a plane is so much easier when you're in San Francisco needing to go to Chicago. So I'm going to Chicago next week. I'll meet some of our customers. You can't do that from New Zealand. You can't get close to people. COVID's over. People want... The difficult thing is people will meet you in a cafe, but maybe not in the HQ. That's the only difference you've got to kind of navigate.
So you have a pretty big team back in NZ now. I think I read somewhere it was about 50 back in NZ. What does the US team look like? And I'd love to hear, managing a sort of a hybrid team or multi-location, multi-time zone team can be challenging. What are some of the rituals or company cultural traditions that you've put in place to help that non-co-located team work as a unit?
It's challenging and we're constantly evolving. I mean, we do a monthly all hands. We are constantly trying to meet up whenever we can, probably more so now. We just had our recent sales kickoff in Chicago, which was probably the best sales kickoff we've had. The asynchronous is hard, mate. Like, I'll be really honest with you. You've got to get on live with people or get in person with them. You know, I do travel back to New Zealand to meet the team there, but it's challenging. I think culture also took a hit across, I'm just saying in general, across many businesses during COVID, because what it created is this mass distribution of people. We had people that were in San Francisco and then they moved to San Diego or they moved to New York. And that's challenging because when we're all in San Francisco, it was like, you know, you're out and you're seeing people, et cetera. So that's a challenge. I think you've got to be open to conversations whenever you can, respecting your time. Honestly, one of the things I do is, some of my team do it as well, is if you're ever coming up against an issue, call them. Don't sit on Slack, pound out a freaking emotive Slack message. Just get on a phone and call them, because you solve issues so much faster that way. And I have to remind myself of that as well.
You've still got an NZ topco, and obviously a US, and others choose to do it the other way around. They'll flip and go US corporation, NZ sub with research. What were some of the components on that? And you make the same decision in retrospect?
No, I would make it a US topco. At the end of the day, New Zealand has been extremely supportive of our company. The New Zealand government is amazing and will remain a New Zealand topco, right? So there's what makes sense for the business and then what makes sense for me. What I guess from my personal perspective that I didn't fully appreciate is just how long I've been in this country. We're going to make this country home. You know, I've got a daughter. She was born in America. Our kids are fully immersed in American culture. I'm going to a baseball game after this. We love it here. The weather's amazing. And so we're making this our home. My wife is English. So we're halfway between families. When I first moved over, I didn't fully appreciate it. But look, New Zealand government, it has been ridiculously supportive and continue to be supportive, which has been amazing.
There's almost a sense of obligation to the NZ government. I love that, respect that. But also on the other side of that, can you talk about material advantages, if there were any, to being US? Was it maybe easier to fundraise, easier to understand stock options and comp the local team?
So let me caveat this by saying I'm not an accountant, but the main attraction of remaining the NZ topco, especially if I was to move back to New Zealand, is there's no cap gain tax. Okay. And so that's obviously attractive. However, if you're an NZ topco and you remain in the country, then there's something called QSBS, which is effectively, it mitigates the tax you need to pay up to $10 million US. However, that's only for US topcos. So at the moment, you know, I'm caught in a little bit of a no man's land, but look, I don't know, like if you're a Kiwi coming over here and you think you're probably going to not go back to New Zealand and you're going to have your team over here, I would go US topco. I've just got a good mate moved over here from Australia. He's only hiring Americans and he's started with a US topco. But you want to pay your fair due as well.
To me, the biggest factors would certainly be legibility of the stock options, and QSBS would be a big part of that to hiring an American who's, you know, weighing up company A versus company B, where company A has QSBS. I can see that being a factor.
Yeah. But I mean, look, everything's different. If you ever got into a position where there was a liquidity event, there are loads of different incentives and triggers and stuff that the board can agree to with founders. And so, yeah, I wouldn't be fixated on it. I think the number one thing you got to do is just build a kick-ass business that actually someone wants to acquire, right?
Yeah.
And if you start to obsess about the what ifs, like, you should absolutely 1000% make sure that from day one, you've set it up for success so that you know you've got no unknowns, 100%. And if things were different, it might have set it up a little bit differently. I certainly would have sold our New Zealand house before we moved over here. Because we just sold that and paid a pretty hefty amount of cap gains tax on that. So we bought it back in 2011.
I've heard from other founders that actually, you know, US investors are happy to invest in New Zealand companies now, you know, maybe more so than they used to be in the past. Is that true? And you know, we're coming up against the time limit here, but would love to get a quick recap of your fundraising journey from the perspective of you 10 years ago. Or what advice would you give to a younger self or a founder following your footsteps?
Yeah, definitely don't worry about the NZ Topco versus US Topco. Like, hopefully I have been part of trailblazing that for other Kiwis. Certainly our board at certain stages wanted us to flip, but the benefit of remaining NZ Topco was greater. It was more the unknown. Investors like, well, we don't really know the New Zealand tax system, and we get it. But I think now those barriers are certainly lower. And if someone's saying, no, you have to be this, then they're probably not worth taking money from. In terms of how to approach investing and some of the things to consider is obviously warm intros are the best intros. But I think one thing that really has always frustrated me is you get inbounded by a Kiwi and they say, hey, introduce me to this person. And you're like, what's your business? Yeah. You know, like, what do you do? What are you raising?
Yeah.
You've got to treat the intro, treat them with some level of understanding, because the best warm intros I have done is when a founder has got to know me and I've got to know their business. Because what they don't understand, and this is that whole thing of perception versus perspective, and their perception is that I'm just going to connect you to anyone. Whereas actually what it is if I can introduce you to an investor in the best possible way, your chances of success go up. And also to consider that I've spent 7 years building a network over here. You can't just go referring anyone, because then you end up looking like a muppet as well. That, you know, someone's trying to come sell you moonbeams. So just have an understanding of that and then run it like a sales process. I've had a CRM for investors for 5 years now. Mm-hmm. And I keep on going back to that. And I'll send them messages and I'll talk to them. And when they come back in again and run it, because I know that that CRM of investors will actually come in handy years into the future. And so just run it like a sales process, because I think also the VCs will appreciate that as well. And just a fast no is better than a slow maybe.
I'm certainly with you on introduction etiquette. And I think we could all push some better education out there.
For sure.
And then run it like sales process makes a lot of sense. Perhaps it's we're less culturally attuned to the no's, and there will be thousands, you know, hundreds of them, if not thousands of them.
Hundreds of no's. Yeah. Hundreds of no's. Yeah, for sure.
My favorite part of these conversations is, what can we do for you? How can we help? Any upcoming asks, any specific roles you're hiring, you want to put the word out, any customers, your dream customers you want introduction to? You said you just closed one of them. How can we help you get the next one? Yeah, are you angel investing, advising, looking to connect with people from that angle?
Yeah, I think for me on the investing side, is anything that distracts me from the current goal is a distraction that I can't have. And I've seen many people go down a path where they get too distracted, but that will come, but not at the moment. I think in terms of where you can be helpful, if you know of any business that is trying to serve the accommodation sector or the transport sector, or if you know of a CPG brand like AB InBev that could do without technology and you want me to speak to someone, more than happy to do an intro, because at the end of the day, events impact a multitude of different businesses. And we have super flexible technology that can be baked into anything from a forecast to a map to a calendar to even one of our customers are printing our events out on the receipt that they send to their SMB customers. I kid you not. And they've been a customer for 4 years now. It's bananas. Awesome though. Like, hey, here's your bill, but also here's 5 events that are going to impact your business in the next 30 days.
That's awesome. Actually, one shout out. You're reasonably active on Twitter/X. Basically, everybody in US tech is, basically nobody in NZ tech is. So maybe people should sign up and go follow you there. Where else could we follow along?
Yeah, I mean, look, I post a lot of stuff on LinkedIn as well. It can be a little bit of a steaming pile of flaming trash sometimes, but there's also some good nuggets in there. And, you know, I do need to increase the amount of blogs that I write as well. I've only written probably 2 or 3 in the past kind of 4 months. So that's just on our blog as well. And look, if there are people out there that have an interest in what we do and they're doing a startup in the data space or they're trying to enable AI, then more than happy to have a discussion with them and give them pointers on where they need to go and where they, if they're willing to make the move, because I think moving out of New Zealand to the US, I think, is an important move for people to make.
Yeah, I think you're living out in the East Bay. You know, would you recommend people follow you out there, or are you going to go sort of downtown or Hayes Valley for the AI? Or
100% Danville, mate. East Bay. It's awesome. I go trail running up in the mountains. I go gravel biking. The weather is like probably 50% better than the city and hotter. Like, I will be in the city working in fog and it'll be like 15 degrees C, and I'll come home and it's 40 degrees. And that's like a 45-minute journey. And you know what it's like, mate. It's awesome. And we've got great schools out here. It's just awesome food, restaurants. I love it, man. I'll probably be here for the rest of my life, I'd say.
Go east, young man. I even saw you doing some gold panning in a river out there somewhere.
Dude, gold panning? Here's the thing about gold panning. is you don't look at your phone. You are next to water, which for me, I find very calming. And you get to pull rare earth minerals out of the ground. Like, it's just bananas. And some of the first pan I ever put down just outside Yosemite, where I was legally allowed to pan, by the way. And I pulled out this piece of gold, mate. And I was just like, I cannot believe it. I literally pulled over on the side of the road, popped out, started panning and pulled out gold. Like, it is ridiculous. And it's just, for me, got me hooked. I've even got a sluice box now. It's amazing.
My five-year-old, if he heard this, would want to hop on a plane straight away and come over and go gold with you. It'd be too good to be true.
My kids love it. My eldest, he's really good. Like, he pulled out more gold when we were in Shasta the other week. We got an Airbnb right on the North Sacramento River. So we literally walked down off the deck, got the music playing, had a beer, and was just panning. Dude, it's just so much fun. Get off the devices, get away from technology. Just so awesome.
How would you contrast raising young family in America versus in New Zealand? And, you know, what's some of the processing you've done on that?
Yeah, just understand, if your kid's 1 or 2 years old, it's going to be tough for you to build a community really quickly. Until our kids started going to school is when we actually really built a community. I think that's probably what it's like in New Zealand as well, but it's okay. And when you do build that community, like, I've just got some great friends over here, make sure if there are things that are at the school that are for parents that enable you to bond with other people, just do it. I've been in this thing called Adventure Guides, and I'm sitting at my third Adventure Guides with my young daughter, and I've met some of the best mates through that. And what it is you get together every month, you know, you have your kids get together, we do rockets out the back of our house, water rockets, you know, those PET bottles, shoot them up in the air. We have beers, you know, we just have an absolute blast. And it's just, it enables you to be immersed in the community, because when I see founders move back to New Zealand, sometimes it's because it's been a challenge to build that community. And dude, like, in our first 2 or 3 years, it's so brutal. Like, all I wanted to do was get back to New Zealand. But now it's just, you know, and what it makes you appreciate, mate, is you can have all the money in the world, but having friends, true friends that you can call on is just so, so important. They are the people you go on holiday with. They are the people that you can call up and help you solve problems. And whether you're in New Zealand or America, if you don't have that, it's really challenging. And I just love that about our area. Super community driven. So I don't know, mate, like, wrap your head around it. In some way, shape, or form.
That's a brilliant place to wrap. Thank you, Campbell. Appreciate you coming over time with me. And it's always a pleasure. I'm excited to help direct some of this magic your way.
All right, awesome. Thanks, David. And I'll talk to you soon.
That's a wrap. Thanks for listening. As a quick reminder, make sure you hit subscribe in your favorite podcast player so you can keep getting stories like this landing your feed every Friday, power you through those weekend chores. I want to give a quick shout out to the boys at Supermix who do all our editing. Zach and Xavier are Kiwi expats themselves. They're building a thriving business in the heart of New York City. A lot of respect. Not a sponsor, just a happy customer here. Also, for my day job, I'm an entrepreneur in residence and an investor at Blackbird Ventures. We're backing the best Kiwi founders wherever they are in the world. My personal sweet spot is pre-seed and seed. I like to say no check is too early, so drop me a line anytime. It's dbooth@blackbird.vc. We'll look forward to seeing you back next week.